your host, Lindsay Tremuda. When I think of women in the food media, I instantly think of Victoire Loup, a French-born writer and consultant who goes between Paris and Los Angeles. For a time, she was a communication director for Le Fooding, and she's written for a number of international magazines and newspapers. More recently, she has published two cookbooks in French and consulted for an international network of chefs. She joins the show today to talk about changes to the food scene, what Los Angeles gets right about cooking, and being involved in mission-driven food projects wherever she finds herself. Hello there, Victoire.
Hi.
For people listening who, you know, may just be discovering you, I want to give people a little bit of context because you and I met many, many years ago already when you were working for Le Fooding.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people might not know what Le Fooding is, but it's essentially sort of a pioneering food industry website with reviews and events and, you know, quite a very distinct point of view in terms of what is good and not good in the food world. Mm-hmm. But you were there sort of at the, not the beginning, but like the second chapter.
When it was kind of taking off. Now it's in its third chapter already.
And so my question initially, I think, is because I don't even know the answer to this. I mean, I'm asking it because I genuinely don't know the answer. When you were working there, was that sort of your first interest in the food world? Or
yeah.
It was. Okay. So how did you get into that?
On a professional level, because the interest for food has always been there from the start. But I used to work in the perfume industry because that's the only thing I knew. My parents and grandparents and everyone before that always worked in Grasse, which is like sort of the capital, the perfume capital of the world. And I didn't know anything else. So I just started working in that realm and like the raw materials and perfumes and all those brands. And then at some point, it was my last internship before I had to get a real job. And I was like, you know what? I've got 6 months to go. I might as well do something that I really love. And I never left. Internship turned into a job. And then here I am, like almost 10 years later, still eating my way into the world every day.
Well, you know, you facilitated my interview with Alexandre for my
mm-hmm.
first book.
That's how
and
we
so,
met.
No, but I think, didn't we meet before that? I feel like we may have
by
met.
By email, but I
by email.
Met, like, face
in
to
person.
Face when you were coming to interview Alexandre. And I remember that day very clearly. I think you do too. Because actually something had happened with your cat that day.
Yeah. So for everyone listening who don't know the trials and tribulations of working on a project, which, you know, you will attest to, mm-hmm. a lot of things go on in your life and you can't necessarily reschedule things. And so I had to interview Alexandre knowing that a couple hours later I was going to have to go home and pick up my cat and bring her to the vet for her passing, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it was a really emotional day. But, you know, I'm glad that you were such like a supportive, kind presence during that day because, you know, like whatever, I needed to push through and I would have just stayed at home crying anyway. So mm-hmm. at least I got out. But anyway, so shortly thereafter, though, I mean, maybe my timeline is wrong, but you then moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, a couple of years after that, actually. I think it was 2 years after you met.
And did you have a pull? I mean, I know you're with someone who, you know, had his sights set on Los Angeles, but like, you know, that's a much different food world.
Yeah. Well, I was not set on LA at first. I've just always loved living abroad and then coming back to Paris. And then like, I've lived in Australia for a short bit. I've lived in the UK for a while, as you might spot from like Franco-American British accent. And then at some point I was like just ready to go somewhere else. And Jérôme, who's now my husband, works in the movie industry. So for him, it was just so easy to go there. And we decided to do that. And gosh, it was like such a huge change. More than anything else, like I've lived in New York and like elsewhere, but this was just for someone who doesn't like to drive and who's just so like attached to that family values and just like that small, Paris seemed like such a tiny city compared to LA. And I grew to love it, but at first it was, wow, a huge change.
And so I'm curious because you left then around 2017, right?
2015, yeah.
Oh, you left in 2015?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But I kept my job as head of media marketing for the fooding. So, and it's still kind of what I do now. I used to do like 2 months over there, 1 month in France, and like back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like I've never left in a way.
Well, but what's interesting is that, you know, you did start to develop your presence in LA, and mm-hmm. You know, you're working with local chefs, some of whom are French, mm-hmm. but not all of them. And so I'm curious, right when you were settling in there, what kind of struck you as being, I don't know, something that LA still does do better than Paris in terms of the food offering or in terms of the way it's organized and that kind of thing?
There's a word that I really don't like in the food vocab, which is ethnic food. And in French, it's even worse. It's cuisine du monde. And it just, over there, there's such a huge respect for the different cuisines of the world, in a way, to put it this way. And like, different neighborhoods have different kinds of food. And even like, it's not just Chinese cuisine. It's like, from this region and this region, you go to different restaurants and the people over there are from there and they're cooking their way in order to, in a way, like honor the traditions and the country that they've left. So I really, really admire the way LA does that. And I think it does it better than London or New York. And it's just also because the city is so spread out, it allows you to just navigate and, in a way, travel to countries you've never seen just by going there and experiencing not just what's in the plate, but the people that welcome you in their own way. And I think in France, we need to learn a whole lot about that, because when I see that, like, we're trying to put French technique or French, like, inspiration in every different cuisine of the world, it just, LA does it so much better.
And do you think that's because France sort of rejects, like, the only way to make a foreign cuisine palatable to the French is to, like, tie it somehow to France? Is that the only way to get people to try things?
Well, I'm sure it deserves such a longer answer, but there's definitely some part of that. There's also, like, the way we taste here is different compared to LA. Like, Angelinos are used to Mexican cuisine and spices. So, yes, they're more accustomed to, like, some traditional Asian food or African foods that, like, to people in France might be a bit foreign. And I think it's just years of learning, like, to meet and learn from people that are very, very different from you, something that Europe is perhaps a bit behind.
Right. Also, I mean, you might argue that America doesn't have the same, like, tradition. You know, they didn't create all of the cooking rules that were then exported all over the world. Okay, so in terms of variety, there's certainly like an openness and a selection mm-hmm. that's just far broader. Now that you've been back, though, because you've come back and you've seen the way things have changed, but you've also been back during COVID, which is a very particular mm-hmm. time. Do you think that things have evolved slightly since you've been gone here in Paris?
I wouldn't really be able to testify since COVID, because I
came back to France
like in April of 2020, and it's just like I almost haven't been able to go to the restaurant since I come back. But yeah, in terms of like how chefs, more than like just foreign chefs in France, which has always existed, like from Australia, from Japan especially, and everything, I feel like women chef, like chef double F-E in French, as they now put it, I've seen a huge transformation in that. And I think, sadly, that it's linked to the Me Too of gastronomy, but it's also, there's always a positive outcome in any crisis. And this is clearly the one I've noticed in the past months and years.
And when you say that you mean they're just sort of emerging with greater visibility?
Exactly. They've always been there, but now we see them and we make an effort to see them and talk about them and like talk about all the different sorts of women, not just the chefs, but like the one working in every type of restaurant, the barman, bow maids. I'm not sure like how, what's the new word for that, but like, it's just so important to put these women on the forefront because they haven't been for so long.
And you know, one thing that seems, you know, because you mentioned Me Too, I mean, that's a good segue. Certainly France has undergone its own
hurricane
reckoning, you know, in different industries, of course, and it continues in various other industries even now. But food, certainly this, you know, it's been about a year of some intense, very public cases. And certainly there are a lot of rumors and a lot of unsubstantiated rumors, but, you know, I'm just wondering, is this going to move the dial? Because, you know, restaurants are about to reopen tomorrow, you know, at least for outdoor dining. And, you know, we're going to be back going out and consuming food from establishments and, you know, the big personalities who may have thought that the last, you know, year has been a bit of a way to hide, you know, can't necessarily hide so much anymore. Do you think that the, you know, what we've been through in the last 18 months will be a lesson to some of these chefs to sort of like shape up? Or
I hope it will be a lesson to the chef, but I can't testify to that. I do think though that some customers, not all of them, but at least some of them, will choose wisely. And as we've seen, especially, well, during the Trump presidency, we were always reminded that we vote with our dollars. And I think we will be able, starting tomorrow, to vote with our euros and go and support, like, I don't know, women-led restaurants or chefs that have been having a great conduct, not only during, like, about this Me Too subject, but about everything else, like using local ingredients, using fair prices. Some of them during COVID were great. I remember Victor Mercier was really, really great for students who were struggling, and he was trying to put a 10-year menu. Well, he's on my list of the restaurants that I want to go visit to, like, just as a way of payback for all the efforts that all of these, like, superheroes have done during COVID. I'm sure other people will not. It's not that they won't notice, it's just perhaps they're not aware, so they can't really make an enlightened decision. But if some of us do that, that's already a start.
You know what I think is the most difficult part is that, you know, I think you and I both have had conversations with different people who are aware of some of the misconduct in in the food industry, and they're protected, and they and no one is willing to take that step to stop the behavior. And it's women too who protect other women and protect men. And, you know, obviously the U.S., and you were in the U.S. when all of the big cases came out. Did you expect that Paris would necessarily follow?
Not necessarily, because even when it was hitting my husband's industry, so the movie industry, I remember reading an article, I think it was Catherine Deneuve, who was in a way protesting against Me Too. And I was like, wow, that's just like France being French again. Just like we're the cliches have no end. And I was really wondering if it was going to be the same for gastronomy. And we've seen that it was a dual answer. It was yes and no, just depending on where you are on the gastronomy scale. But I'm sure like things are evolving and for the better, even if it's slower than the kind of like hurricane that it was in the US.
And also, I mean, to be fair, it's not just, you know, cases of sexual harassment. There's a lot of violence that still exists in, in the food world. And men are equally victimized in that sense.
Exactly.
Responsible, but also victimized. Yeah,
exactly. And women are responsible sometimes of those, like, even if it's just moral harassment of just working very, very long hours in a context that's not healthy and human, but things are slowly changing.
Oh, it just feels like, you know, you sort of just hope that the people who you think you know and the businesses you think you have, you know, sussed out properly don't end up being
sometimes
examples of this.
Trust, because you know them so well. Sometimes it's gut feeling, and sometimes it's just faith.
Right.
And I could actually, like, this has been on my mind for the past few months, because my third cookbook that I've been writing, kind of like in the same realm as the two first ones, is about recipes for a first date. So when you're talking about seduction and love and sometimes a bit about sex, The way I cast it, these chefs was so much like finer and detailed than what I did for the first two books. A, I strongly wanted 30 women and 30 men in the whole list. And also it was just like super, super researched. And again, it's just having faith that none of these chefs will be on a blacklist at some point.
Right, right. But this is the way it goes, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot we can't predict. So you brought up your books, which is what I wanted to get to. In the last year, you have somehow produced two books. The first one is called À la Maison, mm-hmm. and you produced it entirely yourself.
In 2 months.
In 2 months, because
it was not just me. It was a couple of friends, but it was without a publisher, yeah.
Right, right. And it was a charity project.
Yeah.
100%. Okay, so tell me about that. What was the concept? And it was very tied to the moment of COVID, right?
Exactly. It's a little the chicken and the egg, because my second cookbook, Crete, was written before. And this was a project brought by some friends of mine who came up with the idea and said, hey, we want a self-published cookbook. Would you write it? So Crete, which I'm going to talk about afterwards, was ready before. And this is what kind of like enabled me to come up with that animal so fast, because I knew how to do it. I knew my friends were going to be ready. And after 2 weeks, when I came back to the south of France in a great house in front of the sea, kind of just like reading books and watching Netflix, at some point I picked up my phone and I said, guys, I need to do something for charity. I can't spend the entire lockdown just like not doing anything. Do you want to do a charity cookbook where everything that we earn will go to a charity called Ernest, and Ernest gives groceries to families in need? So my idea was to write À la Maison, which is 60 recipes that chefs make at home. So readers can make at home these recipes inspired by chefs who cook when they're not working. And with every purchase, you're allowing families in need to cook at home with raw ingredients, most of the time organic. And it, in like, on top of just providing a meal, it also provides, I don't know, dignity and a sense of family for these people. So it was really, I was extremely happy that my friends agreed to do that. And it did really well. It's still selling pretty well as well. And then a few months later, we published Crete, but like, I didn't write these two in a few months. Like, Crete was ready. It was just like in the starting blocks. Crete is hangover recipes from very famous chefs, both men and women across France. And they each give a story about a night that they had too much to drink and how they made up for it the morning after. So this was extremely fun. And it was, I think it was the 9th best-selling cookbook in France during Christmas. Because it was, in a way, I think it was like a nod to the life we used to have before and the one we're going to have again after COVID. So that kind of nostalgia brought people to buy the book. So here we go. Yeah.
Well, so people need to understand what the word Crete means. It means a hangover, like a bad hangover, yeah. Essentially.
Well, it's a pun on something being cooked and a hangover. If I had to translate it in English, which I'm actually trying to do, I would call it sauced.
Yeah. And so do you have any examples on the top of off the top of your head of some of the recipes that some of these chefs contributed?
It's funny because it's so diverse. Like, everyone has their own, like, there's no rule for a hangover recipe, because some chefs have a super healthy take on it, like with broth or spices. Others, they go super hard on like loaded with cheese or eggs, and it's just so diverse. And I drink very little, and I use this cookbook like any day of the week, because it's just like you've got, I don't know, a truffle omelette from a great bistro in Paris, and then you've got soups and curries, and it's just so diverse that it's almost a recipe that you can make when you're not drunk or hungover.
It's so funny you mentioned cheese, like loaded with cheese. That's totally what I would do.
You do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like a really greasy pizza. That would be my dream.
Hot or cold? Because sometimes you eat it on the night of the event and the morning after you just eat it straight.
How about both? Because everyone knows that leftover pizza, cold leftover pizza is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so you said you're working on this third book, which is the book for the sort of recipes for first dates. When is that going to be released?
Probably November. It will be called Show, which is hot.
This
we're hoping to sell both of them, like both Cuit and Show, in a way that you have like your book for the Friday night and for the Saturday morning. So,
man, what a trilogy.
It's been fun. Well, yeah, and also like my regular job is reviewing restaurants, which hasn't been able to like possible this year. And also my main job, which is like the hidden part of the iceberg, is that I consult brands and chefs who want to move from Europe to the US, or even US-based brands and chefs who just want to develop. So this has been like completely paused for probably months or years because of COVID, and just like I want to give time to all of these chefs to just like have a breather, go back to normal life, and then they can think about again about expansion. But yeah, I'm going to be writing cookbooks for a while, I think, because it's going to be tough for all of these people.
And what have you noticed among, because you know you've been in France now for the bulk of the last year, and you know, there have been, while we haven't been able to do a lot of, you know, like dining at restaurants, there's been a whole lot of interesting concepts and takeaway, and certainly just takeaway as a format is certainly much more robust than it ever was. A, do you think this option will endure, or will, you know, or are the Parisians just going to be like, no, we're good with that now. We're back to our normal sort of programming. And two, was there anything you've seen or tried that was like really creative and and surprising to you?
Well, to give context to an English speaking audience, like takeout and takeaway in France is not at all what you see in New York or in London. Like, we do not know how to do takeaway. Like, it's just, it did not exist. Like, some restaurants just learned on the spot how to package it and how to send it and the temperature and all of this. So it was huge, very steep learning curve. I'm sure that starting tomorrow, people will be so happy to go back to like the terrasse and like eating outside and all of this, and just what makes French joie de vivre, to be cliche. But when fall and winter will come back, yes, like takeout and takeaway is now in their DNA. So I'm sure they will have the idea. It's just going to come back at some point and they will stay. Just not as strongly as what it is in the UK or the US. And as far as interesting concepts are concerned, I was really, really astonished by some concepts of like just sending you great, almost ready food, like not just the meal, but stuff like Ona or other restaurants or pop-ups that were giving you super high quality and super well-sourced preparations that you then have a few steps to prepare, which I took great pleasure in this.
Yeah, I think it actually teaches you, like, almost in a way, it doesn't require much effort, but it certainly requires you to like look at the food that has just arrived and then transform it to a degree, which is, you know, I think in terms of our the way we integrate ingredients and you know, sort of pay more attention to the food that we're consuming, it's it gets us a little bit closer. I know that a lot of, you know, the high-end restaurants were trying their hand at this, and you know, I'm sure they were really just doing it to stay afloat. Some of them are just sort of like, you know, we do not want to be in this business. But also what concerns me, and I'm sure you feel similarly, is sort of like the way that this has benefited Deliveroo and Uber Eats. And, you know, these are not the most ethical platforms. And so it's like,
I'm really trying to make an effort to use TikTok and like other more, I don't know, mission-driven delivery companies, and I just wish the US and the UK would have stronger platforms like these.
But even in France, like Deliveroo and Uber Eats could still be kind of like more acceptable if there was legislation, you know, that that sort of reined in some of these big business practices that are like absolutely outrageous. But, you know, so that's what I'm like concerned about, because now people are like, you know, it's so easy to use Deliveroo and Uber Eats and everyone and their mother is on it, you know, these dark kitchens and whatnot, which is another trend that I'm sure you have a feeling about.
Very strong opinion.
But like, I don't know, I guess it's kind of like, you know, we'll know soon enough, given that things are reopening and how long they stay open, what the future holds. But I guess because dark kitchens are another one of those sort of newer trends, I don't even know if I want to call it that, just like sort of, it's a concept that has emerged more recently. I would love to know what you feel about that, because essentially for those listening, I mean, they exist in the US, they exist in the UK, they're also called ghost kitchens. And essentially they're closed to the public, and it allows restaurants to just prepare food meant for takeaway. And there's like two schools of thoughts, right? Like, is it a bad thing if that's the way young people are naturally leaning toward consuming, like the takeaway? Or is it horrible because it undermines basically all of French tradition?
Well, I think it's hard to regulate consumption on a consumer level. So we have to let the people decide if they want to go to a restaurant or take out or cook or anything. However, what the politicians should take a much closer look at is legislation and making sure, like on the subject of Uber Eats, I remember that in LA during COVID, there was a cap on how much these platforms could take from the restaurants. And it was really reduced until the crisis was over. And I just wish we had done the same thing in France. And especially in a country like where we're supposed to be proud of our restaurants and our gastronomy. And as far as dark kitchens are concerned, I can't say I'm against the concept, because it would be like so, I don't know, archaic of me. But I just wish that people would take a closer look at who is cooking in these kitchens and how much they're getting paid. Same goes with these poor drivers who just like, they're using Vélib, which is like a bicycle that you rent per hour. And they're just...
Yeah, they're killing themselves.
I didn't want to use that word, but it's exactly what I thought. And it breaks my heart that it's not more regulated, considering how much money these platforms are making.
Exactly.
So I would to buy from a ghost kitchen if it was just like, if I knew that the people working there were as well paid as they would be in a restaurant.
So you know, you're in Paris now, you're going to eventually go back and forth to LA. What do you think you're going to take away from this particular moment in, I don't know, let's say Paris's like food phase? I mean, it's obviously super weird. It is not, you know, normal dining in Paris, but is there anything you're sort of excited to have witnessed that you're going to take back with you?
I was extremely proud to see how people, I don't know, they just evolved and adapted. So, well, they didn't really have a choice, but for a country and a culture that's like so, I'm not sure, attached to what tradition is, I thought all generations of chefs and all of these teams just made such a huge effort and evolved sometimes even to the day when the government was saying yes on one day and no on the other. And all of these chefs, they were just like remaining as optimistic as they could. And this was a huge lesson. And it's just like, it's teaching every one of us to just play it day by day and then we just hope that everything will go well.
And the proof is that it's not impossible.
Exactly.
It is possible. Like, there are things that are actually possible. You just have to, it was just a pandemic that lit the fire under a lot of butts.
I hope, as you said earlier, that we will learn from these lessons and just not go back the way it was before.
Well, from your mouth to the universe, right? last question. Give me one place that you plan to go this week that's going to reopen.
Mokonuts.
Mokonauts, yes! You and I both have an undying affection for Moko and Omar, and I second that. Absolutely.
I live on the other side of town, but honestly, like, I will go there if not.
I know, you make cookie. Yeah, it's a destination. It really is.
Yeah.
Victoire, when are listeners going to be able to find something of yours in English?
Well, let's just put it in the universe. It's okay. Up to the publishers. Like, I've been trying to pitch stuff in English for a while. I just think that it's because I'm a tiny bit more famous in France that it worked better here. But let's hope so. If it's a translation of Cuit or anything else, I really do hope so.
Okay. Anybody listening who can make this happen, make it happen. And in the meantime, everyone can follow you on Instagram. I'm assuming that's the best place to follow you. Victoire Louvre. And if you do read French, you must pick up À la maison and Cuit. And soon enough, show. Victoire. Thank you for coming on the show, and let's get a cookie together.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks, Lindsay.
That's the show for today. As always, thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing with friends. You can find all previous episodes of the New Paris podcast wherever you stream your podcasts and on World Radio Paris. If you're enjoying these conversations, please consider picking up a copy of the New Paris book or my recent release, The New Parisienne, from your local booksellers. Until next time, à bientôt.